This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Remember the popular 1991 film The Commitments? It's a comedy about a young man in Dublin who puts together and manages a band with the mission of bringing classic soul music to Ireland. The screenplay was co-written by my guest Roddy Doyle, who wrote the novel it was based on. Doyle won this year's Booker Prize, Britain's most important literary award, for his new novel Paddy Clark, Ha Ha Ha. His latest movie is opening in the States. It's called The Snapper. Doyle wrote the screenplay and the novel it's based on. The film was directed by Stephen Frears, who also directed My Beautiful Laundrette, The Grifters, and Dangerous Liaisons. Snapper is slang for baby, and the story, which is set in Dublin, is about a teenager who gets pregnant and won't tell anyone who the father is. Some writers might have turned the story into a tragedy. Doyle gives us a family comedy.
Well, I deliberately wanted to emphasize the joyful and the celebratory nature of the pregnancy. And in many ways, I mean, the child's place in or outside of wedlock is irrelevant. You know, a baby is a baby. And I just felt I wanted to celebrate pregnancy per se. I also must admit that I had a general idea that I was going to write a comic novel when I was sitting down to write it. Sharon, the character herself, in many ways dictated the rest of the book. She's a very strong person, and having got herself involved in this rather sordid, unfortunate incident, she makes the most of it and turns, you know, what is a bad accident into an achievement, and drags her family along with her and forces the family and the whole community to accept the baby on her terms rather than on their terms. So I deliberately wanted it to be a book that emphasised the positive, I suppose. If it had been a more middle-class family, I suspect more of the consequences, as you call them, would have come into it, the shame, what will the neighbours think, that type of thing. But the father very quickly, within about 8 minutes of the film starting or less, dismisses what the neighbours think. He doesn't care. He really doesn't care what they think. As for his becoming more and more involved in the pregnancy, that was, you know, as I became more interested in him, he began to take over the book and would have given birth to the child himself if it had been physically possible. But his involvement with the biology of it and his reading every woman and that, I suppose, is a bit of wishful thinking, that there is, you know, a new man living in Dublin.
Yeah, well, actually, there's a very funny scene with that where the father is reading a book about pregnancy, and it's also a book about a woman's body, and he's absolutely fascinated by it and ends up learning new things to do with his wife in bed.
Yes, yeah, he discovers at the age of about 45, he discovers foreplay.
So you said before that you thought that had this family been more of a middle-class family, perhaps the story would have ended up being more about the consequences. So what are the differences that you'd see between a working-class and middle-class family and their reaction to a teenage pregnancy?
Well, I suppose in parts of Dublin, at least one in every three children are born outside marriage. And it's almost habitual, do you know what I mean? So that it happens in every family, or not in every family, but in most families. Everybody knows somebody in the working class areas of Dublin. So it's not a shameful thing in the public sense. It's not a big thing. It's not a shock or a horror. It would have been perhaps 20 years ago, but it certainly isn't now. In middle class areas, the old attitudes, you know, whether it's right or wrong is debatable, but in the middle class areas, the old attitudes die hard, so that pregnancy outside marriage is still a shameful thing, still is something that marks the neighbours. It's something of a stigma, or can be. So that's the general attitude, really. That's the difference between the two. I'm a bit reluctant to go too deeply into it, because when you do make general statements, you're being inaccurate all the time, because there are going to be thousands of individuals who will prove you wrong.
Now, Sharon, the pregnant character in your story, she wouldn't have an abortion because she thinks of that as murder. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the people in your stories aren't exactly running their lives by the book. I mean, they're not exactly patterning their lives according to what they think the church would like.
No, the church doesn't really enter into any of my books, except in a cosmetic sense in Paddy Clark. No, I think it's an attitude that would be very strong in Ireland. Not necessarily an attitude that's dictated by the church, although that would enter into it. It's just that there is an attitude that people would almost immediately, without even thinking about it, dismiss abortion in any circumstances as murder. Bearing in mind that the book was written about 4 years ago, attitudes, I think, since various Sex abuse cases have come up here in Ireland, and there have been constitutional considerations. Attitudes have become a bit more flexible since then. But when I was writing the book, I've no doubt whatsoever that the vast majority of women in Sharon's position would have just said it's, particularly of her class, would have said it's murder and wouldn't have delved deeper into the possibility of having an abortion.
Is there good access to birth control in Dublin?
There is, yes. I could say that now, but if you'd asked me the question 5 years ago, I'd have said there isn't, no.
What's changed?
Times have changed. Availability, basically, public knowledge. There are now advertising hoardings all over the place pleading with people to use condoms, whereas in the past, the advertising hoardings, although they weren't used, would have been used to plead with people never to get into a position where they had to use condoms. Attitudes have changed somewhat.
Mm-hmm. Your previous film, The Commitments, did very well in the United States, and the character is the family is basically the same family, although the name has been changed in the new film. And in The Commitments, the oldest son wants to live the life of rock and roll, so he wants to put together a rock and roll band and manage them, which he does, and that's what the film's about. There's a lot of musical references in your work. Has music always been very important to you? Are you somebody who's, especially when you were young, defined yourself by your musical taste?
Yeah, certainly when I was a teenager, I often determined my friends according to what they listened to, you know. And now music is still quite important to me. I'll often hear a piece of music and, like a lot of people, I know exactly what I was doing the first time I heard that. Or these days I often will force the issue by when my children were born, the day after, if I had free time, I'd go into a music store and buy some new piece of music just so I could associate the music with the births, you know. So music is quite important to me. But I just find that it's all over the place anyway, and I just wanted my books to reflect that. I mean, you can't enter a supermarket or turn on, you know, go into a house or anything at all, but you're hearing snatches of music. And one of the disturbing things I find more recent trends is how advertising has kidnapped all the best rock and roll songs and used them to their own purpose. And that means that we hear even more music, you know. So it's just all pervasive. It's all around us. So characters in my books tend to just break out into song all the time, sometimes, you know, appropriately, sometimes just for the heck of it.
In the home of the family in The Commitments, at least in the movie, there's two pictures on the wall. One is the Pope, and above that is Elvis Presley. Are rock and roll and religion the twin deities?
Oh, yeah. Well, Elvis is God, and the Pope is God's anointed. No, I think the Pope thing needs a little bit of explanation. The Pope was here. He paid a visit here in 1979. And virtually every house in Ireland ended up with a picture of the Pope or something, some, you know, relic, or not a relic, but some souvenir of the Pope's visit hanging up on the wall or on the mantelpiece or something or other. That's why I'm inclined when I'm describing rooms or that, there's always something about the Pope there. The problem with that, and I think I might drop it after a while, is that it's seen inaccurately. It's seen as being the all-pervasive influence of the church or whatever, or the Pope looking down on the family. But it just happens to be, it was a huge event in Ireland in September 1979, and it left its, it's, if you like, physical mark on all the houses in the country. So that's why the Pope is always up on the wall. Elvis is a huge, huge semi-god in Dublin. Elvis and, you know, one or two footballers are, in the male world, the big people to look up to. Despite all the evidence to the contrary.
Are there Elvis impersonators in Dublin?
Virtually every working class estate in Dublin would have at least one Elvis impersonator, yeah. And you don't have to actually spend too long. You can see them coming along the way. They still, despite most of them are in their early 60s, they still try best to look like. And they all, unfortunately, I'd be a big fan of Elvis's 50s recordings, but they all try to, in appearance, tried to capture the Las Vegas look, you know, which is probably easier for them, actually, you know.
Right, because they've put on a few pounds over the years.
Yes,
anyways.
Exactly.
Were you ever in a band yourself?
I was never in a band. I never managed a band. I can't play an instrument and I can't sing.
But you probably wish you could do all of the above.
I wish, and I still wish I could do all of the above. Yeah, no, I couldn't be bothered managing a band. That wouldn't be in me. No, but I'd love to be in a band, all right. But I never will be. I'm able to fantasize and realize the limits of my talents at the same time.
I know you taught for many years. Did you have a lot of students who were in bands and who had the ambition of really making it?
Yes, and for years, yes. There was a spell, and it may well be there as well, I'm a bit out of touch now, but there was a spell when, oh, a good one-third of the people I taught were in bands or just about to join bands or just had been flung out of bands. At one stage, Dublin just seemed to have more bands than any other activity, you know, probably the influence of U2.
Right, they made it, so I can too.
Yes, yeah, unfortunately, not many of them have, unfortunately. It's a huge cloud, U2. I don't blame them at all, but it's almost a burden that Dublin has had to bear. It's not their fault, it's probably Dublin's fault, but it constantly, if a band bring out a new single or a good single and it gets to number 97 in the British charts, they are immediately branded the new U2 and then explode and disappear without trace.
Now, you recently gave up teaching after, what, 14 or 15 years, I believe?
14 years, yes.
Yeah, what made you decide to give it up? In previous interviews, you'd always said that so much of your inspiration and your material came from teaching and watching your students.
Yeah, well, I suppose, you know, simply I changed my mind. there was two reasons, really. The first was that I had always had a lot of free time to write. I had never had any problem incorporating the two jobs. I could be home at 4:30. My wife usually finished work at about 6:30. So I'd do a couple of hours work writing, and that was enough for me. And the holidays here for teachers are very generous, so that combination kept me going. But when the children arrived, I've now two very young kids, that free time began to dwindle away. And it's really, I still, by the time they were in bed and we had the house cleaned up, it might be touching 9 o'clock or thereabouts, and I'd go into the room for another hour, maybe an hour and a half, and that was fine. I could still do a bit of work, but at a cost. There was nothing else to my life, you know, or, you know, to our life. So really, I just decided that one of the jobs had to go. And, you know, in the interim, teaching had become less important to me. I suppose because my own children were in the house, I became a good deal less fascinated with other people's. And on top of that, the repetitive nature of the job, the reading the same texts and imparting the same information just began to wear me down after a while. But it wasn't until I made up my mind one day in September of last year. And I sort of, within the space of a couple of days, went from liking the job to actually disliking it an awful lot very, very quickly. I suppose because I'd made my mind up.
So what did you start to dislike once your mind changed?
Oh, the sheer, like reading Lord of the Flies for about the 57th time. It's a great, great book, but, you know, I've only read my own books once. And here I was yet again reading about Piggy. And, you know, I almost cheered when Piggy's head hit that stone and it smashed. That was good. You know, at least in the realization that I'd never have to read it again, you know. And it's not the book's fault. It's a wonderful book. But I was also, I constantly mention it because it almost makes me nauseous to mention some of the other books. Like I read Emma by Jane Austen to kids who could not give a toss about Emma or Jane Austen about once a year, you know. And I hated the book from the word go, even when I was reading it as a student in university, when there were no strings attached, if you like. And I hate it even more now. So I had to force myself through it, really, taking anti-nausea tablets for the last couple of months of the school year.
My guest is Roddy Doyle. He wrote the novels The Commitments and The Snapper and adapted both of them into films. He also won the 1993 Booker Award in England, the Britain's most prestigious literary award. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Writer Roddy Doyle is my guest. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in a place called Kilbarrick on the north side of Dublin, about 4 miles out from the city centre.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have a new novel that I assume is semi-autobiographical. It's called Paddy Clark, Ha Ha Ha, and it just won the Booker Prize, the most prestigious literary prize in the UK. What got you thinking about childhood? Your previous fiction has been about people who are older than that.
Yeah, well, it's not autobiographical or semi-autobiographical, although the background and the geography are my own. The story isn't mine. Well, what I wanted to do after I'd finished writing The Van, my third novel, was to write something completely different, just for the heck of it, to see if I could. I thought The Van would be a much better book if there were no further installments of The Rabbit Family. And having written three books that I think are quite separate, but in broad ways similar, I wanted to just test myself to see if I could do something that was entirely different to the previous ones. So I decided I'd write from the point of view of a child. and see if I, a 10-year-old child, and see if I could really get into his head and capture the way he spoke and his own logic and the type of personality he was. And I also decided to set it in the past because dialogue comes quite easy to me. And I wanted to really just test myself again to see if I could capture the way people spoke in 1968. Now, I, you know, was 10 in 1968. I don't remember what people spoke like. So I just wanted to, you know, use my imagination and just see if I could do it. And if I couldn't, I'd dump it and do something else instead. But what really got it going, the book going emotionally, was the birth of my elder son, Rory. Within minutes of him being born, I had this rush of memories from my past, which I hadn't given my past much thought at all. And I suppose anticipating his future, I was recalling my past. And they sparked off the whole thing. I began to list down names of television programmes that I watched as a kid, and they sparked off memories. And those memories, in consequence, sparked off other memories. Now, I don't trust memory. I think we remember lots of things happening to us which never did actually occur, but it didn't matter. Mm-hmm. And I rejected most of the memories and created fictional scenes out of some other ones. So that's where the whole idea came from.
In thinking back to your childhood, I'm wondering if you saw your family life as tragedy or comedy or something in between. And I ask that because in for instance, The Snapper, you take a situation that some people would consider tragic and you make it a comedy.
Yeah, well, my own upbringing was actually, looking back on it now, was very, very happy. I don't recall my parents ever fighting in my company. It wasn't a very full house in the sense that, you know, by Irish standards at the time, it wasn't that big a family. There were two parents and four children. But it was a very full house in the sense that it was a very active house. My father was unlike a lot of fathers of that generation, you know, the fathers who sit in a corner and don't want to be disturbed. He was a very flamboyant man, still is in many ways. You know, he's always a flamboyant dresser. He was always singing, played the banjo, played the piano, inflicted the banjo on us every day. My mother also was a very funny woman. My father was very witty. My mother was also very, very funny, a great mimic in a quieter sort of a way. So the house was always very, very, very light, very happy. And it's just looking back from an adult's perspective that my parents made an awful lot of sacrifices to make it that way. Obviously, I didn't appreciate it at the time. It just happened. It came with the house. But I look back on it now with a great deal of affection and gratitude. So the darker moments in Paddy Clark, for example, aren't, I'm glad to say, my moments.
You've written four novels, right?
Yes.
Did I count right?
You did, yeah.
And the first one was The Commitments, which you published yourself back in 1987. What made you think that this is the direction you should head in? You should publish this yourself.
Well, I got into the habit of writing from around about 1982. I had done one or two satirical articles for university papers when I was there, but I wouldn't consider that part of the writing habit. I just wrote them on a whim very quickly and handed them over, and some of them were published. And then I gave up for some years. I didn't do any writing at all as I got into the role of being a teacher. But in 1982, I remember during the summer holidays, and we get 3 months holidays here, I gradually got into the habit of sitting down for a while every day and writing. I spent about 4 years writing what I now know is a dreadful novel, and sent it off to all the Irish publishers and then all the British ones at enormous expense. It was a huge thing, about the weight of a couple of house bricks, and cost a fortune to send all over, you know, the British Isles. And what struck me as being quite bad was that about two of them actually took any interest in reading the novel itself or even a synopsis of it. The rest just dismissed it completely. They had no interest in knowing about it because it wasn't coming through an agent. I didn't have an agent, and it struck me, I approached a few and they didn't want me because I hadn't been published, and it struck me as being sort of not only one gate locked, but both gates were locked. You couldn't be published without an agent. You couldn't get an agent unless you'd been published. So I wrote The Commitments very, very quickly, and I felt very good about The Commitments, and it began to dawn on me that the other thing I'd done over 4 years was a piece of nonsense. But I felt that The Commitments was a bit different and a bit fresher, and I decided to did a bit of investigating with a friend of mine here called John Sutton, and we found out that it wasn't all that expensive to print and publish the book. That I could do it with the same amount of money that I'd have gone to the bank looking for if I was buying a second-hand car. So that's what we did in 1987. Rather than, you know, send it off to the publishers again and wait for all the rejection slips, I decided just to do it myself.
And how often self-published books don't really get noticed. They don't get reviewed as much. They don't get distributed as well in bookstores. How did your book get noticed?
Well, luckily in Ireland, the papers are more open. The newspapers are more open to that type of project. You still get that old snobbery in some of the British papers where they'll only review hardback books, you know. So, but that wasn't the case in Ireland, and hasn't been, and still isn't the case, where any book that arrives on the desk of the literary editors in some of the, not all, but some of the Irish papers is going to get reviewed. It may appear sort of some months after you want it to, but in the case of The Commitments, I think because it had a good cover, for one thing. It was an immediately striking cover. And it I remember we spent a lot of time on the press release and wrote this outrageous press release. I can't actually remember what was in it, but I know it annoyed a few people. So it gathered a lot more attention than it would have done normally, because it was vanity publishing, really, when you look at it. Mm-hmm. But it was reviewed by a lot of the papers, and some of them favourably, and a lot of them quite hostilely. But what was quite apparent was that nobody was indifferent about the book. They either loved it or hated it. And that, I think, generated interest as well. And it became something of a cult book before it was published in Britain.
You've said that because of the success of U2, whenever an Irish rock band puts out a new record, if it's good, it's always called, oh, the next U2. Do you think you're going to have the same effect on literature, that now people are going to be, oh, the next Roddy Doyle? And how would you feel about that?
Well, I certainly hope not. One of the criticisms of my work in Ireland has been that it's so easy, anybody could do it. Look at it on paper. Anybody could do that, despite the evidence, and nobody else has done it so far, you know. So it may well be that people would start writing in the same style I do, perhaps, you know, in simple English with a lot of dialogue or whatever the other ingredients of my work are. But so far, there hasn't been a huge invasion of these people into the literary world. But comparisons are inevitable. I mean, reviewers will always, for convenience sake, will always compare somebody's work to another person's. And I suppose because I have won the Booker Prize, and because my books have been very successful here and in Britain and Canada and other places, that the comparisons are almost inevitable. But I wouldn't take them too seriously. I don't think I'd find them irritating, really.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Roddy Doyle's new film is called The Snapper. His new novel is called Patty Clark, Ha Ha Ha. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.